Greetings. Welcome. This is critically acclaimed. No, I won't do that anymore.
Was that your Fabio?
Greetings, friends. Welcome to Critically Acclaimed. It's the film review podcast.
Where we are Fabio.
My name is Whitney Fabio Seibold. I'm a film critic. And with me, as always, is the utterly brilliant and dash handsome Fabio. Please introduce yourself.
I am Fabio. I am a professional critic and everybody calls me Fabio.
Why are we Fabio-ing, you might ask?
It's because I found a book.
In front of us on the table, before we get to the film reviews, yeah. Which we'll get to.
Yeah, we have some movie reviews this week.
But we have something more exciting to share.
I found a book. So you might recall, in the heyday of the romance novel, like the 80s and 90s, and I maybe still to this day, I honestly don't know if Fabio's still doing it or not, but...
Fabio, maybe not so much, but romance novels have never gone away. There's no history.
Romance novels are a highly successful and billion-dollar book industry. A lot of people read them. I have no slight whatsoever to the genre, whatsoever. But there was this interesting period where one model was like male model was on the cover of seemingly every romance novel in the 80s and 90s, and that man's name was Fabio. And Fabio was this incredibly worked out, a lot of muscles, chiseled features, giant, like, flowing blonde locks.
His hair was, like, his signature. Like, he had a big sort of Miles O'Keefe chin and, very sharp cheekbones.
He looked like Conan's sexier brother. That's what you got out of him.
Supermodel Chippendales physique and, gigantic hair.
Yeah, and he was incredibly popular and a lot of people swooned.
An Italian model, yeah.
And I found out that not only did he model... for romance novels, he also wrote or co-wrote or possibly put his name on someone's ghostwritten novel.
Yeah, I was about to say, let me hand that book to me.
Yeah, there's another name on here.
It says Fabio, and I'm sure he trademarked his own name.
Oh,
that was his real first name. I think it's Fabio Lanzini.
I forgot his actual real last name.
Let me look. If you look on the inside, it'll say like, oh, here it is. Viking is the title of the book.
Yes.
By Fabio, in collaboration with Eugenia Reilly.
There you go.
Now, there is no way Eugenia Reilly is the actual ghostwriter's actual name either.
I don't know, man. I don't know. They've worked with Fabio multiple times. They also worked on Rogue.
Lanzoni, excuse me.
They also worked on Rogue and Pirate and A Bushwhacked in Time Wedding. A Time Travel Christmas. Eugenia Reilly's been around the block a few times.
Yeah.
But I was particularly enticed by this particular Fabio novel.
Viking.
Because, you would imagine, okay, so he's a Viking and he does sexy Viking things, right? Mm. You would be wrong. Here's the plot. This is just like the two-sentence description on IMDb, on Amazon.com. Mm. Preparing to film a Viking epic, movie star Marcello is transported back to Viking times, where he becomes a king caught between two warring tribes and meets a beautiful, captive French princess who happens to resemble his real-life love. So basically, it's like that John Candy movie Delirious, except instead of John Candy winding up in a soap opera, it's like Fabio winding up in a romance novel.
Yeah.
At least that's the pitch, and that's a hell of a pitch.
Would you like me to read the dedication?
Sure.
I dedicate this and all my works to women, the guardians and teachers of love for all humankind.
Lot to unpack there. Yeah, lot to unpack
stay,
there.
Stay classy, Fabio.
Stay classy, Fabs.
So we had to share.
Yes.
We had to share. We have film reviews for you.
We do.
But this book takes far more
Fabio,
attention.
Fabio was the captain of our hearts for a minute there. This week on Critically Acclaimed, we're reviewing the new releases, Pixar's Turning Red, The Adam Project, the new Shudder horror thriller, The Seed, and a movie that apparently came out a while ago. I missed it. Whitney saw it while he had a few days on vacation. He's really eager to talk to you about Diana the Musical.
Diana, and let's start with Diana the Musical, because it's an old one. So we'll do a little catch-up.
Okay.
If we may.
Let's do it.
Let's do it. Yeah, this was really
This is stunning. Why you're really here, and you know. We went from Fabio to Diana the Musical.
Yeah. So Diana the Musical was released on Netflix back in October of 2021.
Oh, my
so
this, God. This is months like 6 months old.
Yeah, this is months old. This is a while back. God. But it got nominated for a bunch of Razzies. I know the Razzies are meaningless, but...
They called attention to a film you didn't know.
They zeroed in on this one, and I hadn't heard about this. Diana the Musical is a film stage production of a Broadway musical that was a victim of COVID. It was set to open right when COVID was in full swing, right when lockdowns were happening. They filmed a rendition of it and put it on, you know, without an audience, obeying all COVID protocols.
Right, much like they did Hamilton. Hamilton didn't have an audience when they filmed it.
I thought it was like several live performances edited together for Hamilton.
I think it might have been maybe a combination. I actually don't know. Actually, you know what? I might be wrong about it.
There was no audience for this version of Diana, and it is a musical version of the life of Diana, Princess of Wales. The subject of the movie Spencer, if you need to catch up a little bit.
Sure.
And it's as unseemly as that sounds.
Oh, no.
Now, the music is... I guess fine for a Broadway musical. It's like catchy in that really obnoxious sort of way where you'll find yourself humming to it in spite of yourself.
Yeah.
But the lyrics are very simple.
Okay.
And it tells the story of Diana as she was, proposed to by Prince Charles and the big wedding and sort of the terror she felt being the Princess of Wales. Now, if you watch Spencer, it turns Diana into this very, tragic, depressive figure. It focuses very much on how isolated she was while living in Buckingham Palace and how she had a few moments to bond with kids, but never really had an ally, especially not in her husband, least of all in her husband, and she was always expected to essentially act the part of the royal while, you know, subsuming every detail of her personal life. She wasn't allowed to be a person. This musical... they bond over going to the opera, that is Diana and Charles. And the first, one of her musical numbers is, at heart, she's really a rock and roller. And all the musical kind of like springs out into all this rock. And she's singing about how inside she's really wants to be a rock and roller. She's like a free spirit. And she goes through all of this. There's a number sung by the paparazzi who follow her around. And how she is just an object and how that really kind of... sits poorly with her.
Well, as it would.
Charles, it's pretty well known now, was having an affair with a married woman all throughout his marriage.
And really openly so. Everyone knew about it. Like, at least everyone in the family knew. Anyway.
And I think he couldn't marry his intent.
Camilla Parker Bowles had previously been divorced. Mm. And at the time, that was considered such a scandal that it was not even conceivable.
Even though they were having an affair, and they just continued having an affair when he married Diana. Diana also had a 5-year affair while they were married.
Yeah.
And when they introduced the man she had an affair with, Peter Hewitt, I believe was his name, he shows up like on a horse with his shirt off, talking about what a sexy Fabio type of fellow he was. What this musical is doing is sort of giving this push and pull between Diana's desire to be with Peter Hewitt, but also repair her marriage with Charles.
And also be a rock star.
And also be a rock star on the inside. And what this musical does is actually put a lot of the sympathy in all of this story on Camilla. Because Camilla is the one who's been having an affair with Charles, and he's the one who's trying to keep up appearances by being a royal with Diana. But Camilla is the one who's saying, well, but you love me. Mm-hmm. You had to leave me. You were the woman you were already having an affair with to go marry this other woman. And I don't like that you're constantly leaving me to go back to this woman you clearly don't love that you married. So it's kind of the Camilla story.
That's really weird.
It's really bizarre. And
Not that you couldn't tell that story from Camilla's perspective and make an interesting story out of it.
Well, make Camilla the musical then. Don't make Diana the musical.
Weird musical, but yeah, it's okay.
After Starlight Express, all bets are off. Okay, you can make a musical about it.
I was looking this up, and the music was done by David Bryan. Do you know who David Bryan is?
No,
he was a keyboardist for Bon Jovi.
Oh God!
And on top of that, all he'd done a little work. He won a Tony for the musical Memphis.
Okay.
And he had also done, I believe, the music for the Toxic Avenger stage musical.
Oh, fun. Okay.
So
that's more appropriate for the Toxic Avenger stage musical.
It's an interesting choice. I would have gone maybe with someone British.
Diana.
I don't know. Maybe not some guy from Jersey. I don't know.
Diana.
New Jersey, not actual Jersey.
Not Jersey.
Jersey would make sense. Jersey would fill that criteria quite nicely.
Diana gets her revenge on her situation
by
being the tabloid star.
Right.
And there's a song about, it's called Fuck You Dress. And how she puts on the Fuck You Dress and like is extra sexy in public. And she gets all of the paparazzi attention. And that's her way of sort of like thumbing her nose at the royal family.
That was one of the more brilliant things about her in that situation. When she was going through hell and she had like an eating disorder and it was really horrible for her and her whole family. But she knew how to manipulate the media. She knew how to get them on her side and to keep attention on her as a positive figure rather than just wither into the background as yet another, you know, another royal.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's good to have that, I guess. But I love the idea of the Fuck You Dress. It sounds satirical.
If it were campier or more fun, it would be. But this is played totally earnestly.
Oh, God.
And they're... They downplay a lot of Diana's depression. Like, they mention her eating disorder. They mention that she was a cutter.
Yeah.
But they don't really, like, face that head on. And they're trying to make Diana's life seem like the life of a tabloid writer. There's the same actress who plays Queen Elizabeth also plays a famous tabloid writer who was writing her story at the time.
Interesting choice.
So they're trying to make her life seem like it was a tabloid.
Okay.
Which means they're downplaying a lot of the less sensational things and playing up the more sensational things. And if they were really kind of going camp with it, maybe that it would be tasteless. But, you know, there's a place for tastelessness, I suppose.
Sure,
especially if you're trying to make a campy musical about the tragic life I'm
not saying it's impossible. Like, Diana's life was very, very tragic.
Mm.
But I'm not saying there isn't a way to approach that with some wit, you know, but this doesn't sound like the best possible version of that.
No, and it really just crashes into the ground when they try to address Diana's charity work.
No,
where she actually had like causes.
Yeah, she was nominated for a Nobel Peace Prize for like trying to get rid of like landmines that were still killing
the
people.
Landmines which they just kind of mentioned in passing. Yeah. But the musical number is devoted to the fact that she visited AIDS patients.
Yeah.
And one of the
time when that was not a thing.
One of the patients has a number. He is like the most stereotypical like supporting gay character you could imagine. Where he like says like doesn't have character. He's just sort of like this jumble of stereotypes who sings this number about thank you for coming to visit us poor beleaguered
gay
men in the AIDS ward.
No, I don't
want you. Yes, I'm glad for your publicity and that sounds awful. It turns like it's really kind of hero worshipy shit and
Good that people were actually like willing to like bring those issues to light because a lot of people really weren't. But let's not go fucking nuts and give her all the goddamn what the I can only imagine Diana would find that distasteful.
I think Diana would find a lot about what we're talking about her life, even a movie that is ostensibly very tasteful like Spencer, to be perhaps tasteless. Like, she wouldn't want that kind of stuff necessarily out in public.
It's hard to imagine that she would be totally down with it.
So we're trying, and the fact that publicity and paparazzi was what ultimately killed her.
Yeah.
Like, pretty explicitly, she was being chased into a tunnel by paparazzi and cars and got into a car wreck.
Yeah.
Paparazzi killed Diana, and that more publicity and all these stories about her life, however earnestly we're trying to contend with what we did, was just, I don't think it would sit well with her at all.
No.
I think just let Diana be.
Yeah.
Don't give her Diana the musical. She would have hated
that just sounds like a tasteless way to handle it. I haven't seen The Crown. I hear that's a very good series. I haven't seen it. I don't know. I thought Spencer did a good enough job about trying to get people into her headspace.
Yeah.
But even then, it's played off like kind of a horror movie. One could argue that might not be the best way to do it, but...
Yeah, well, I think they were pretty sedate and, like I said, tasteful. Spencer, I thought, was pretty a tasteful movie.
Yeah.
The actress who plays Princess Diana in this, her name is Gianna DeWall, and it's not her fault.
Okay.
She's actually perfectly fine.
Well, that's nice.
You know, and they dress her up in all of, like, actual outfits that Diana wore, like famous suits and dresses that she wore.
Very famous.
They recreated a lot of those outfits that she wore, and, you know, they gave her the hairdo, and, you know, she plays it to the amount that a Broadway role of this scope demands of her. Like, she, you know, sings all the songs incredibly well. It's not really trying to go into this really emotional space. It's trying to play it up for the stage. Yeah. And
yeah, that doesn't sound very good.
Golly, it is so terrible.
Well,
in a way that's almost amusing.
Well, do you feel enriched for having gone through this experience, negative though it may have been? Do you feel like your life is more complete?
It was
now?
So negative I had to share. It was okay. So negative that I kind of want people to see this disaster.
Okay.
Because it is so ill-advised, and everything just, the tastelessness just mounts with each passing scene.
Oh my God.
This aggressive tabloidization. It almost feels like a Simpsons parody of a musical.
Oh, well, that's good. I remember I was talking, when we reviewed a few months, maybe last year sometime, the Clint Eastwood Lee Marvin Western musical Paint Your Wagon.
Oh, God.
Which is,
that was awful.
Which
too.
Is really awful. Not that it directly compares to this, but it was a Simpsons joke that they rented a Lee Marvin, Clint Eastwood Western thinking it was going to be super badass and were like shocked and horrified to find out that it was a musical.
They made up fake songs for the Simpsons version. But
they
did.
But it's not that far off. And
gonna paint that wagon.
Gonna paint it fine. Yeah. Gonna paint that wagon because that wood is pine. I found out when we recorded that, and I mentioned it to some people, that apparently a large portion of a certain people of a certain age who grew up watching The Simpsons thought that Paint Your Wagon was a joke movie.
It's a real movie.
They didn't realize that was an actual film. They thought they made up a movie that was so ridiculous it couldn't possibly exist. Real film.
Yep.
Real film. Well, listen, we're going backwards this time. Normally we start with like the biggest movie. Mm-hmm. And this time we started with a movie that you should have seen 6 months ago. So let's just keep working backwards. Let's keep working back to front. And let's talk about a movie that I saw on Shudder this week. It's a new film. It is called The Seed.
Is it? It's The Bad Seed, isn't it?
No.
Oh, it's not. Okay. No. Is it Demon Seed? The Julie Christie
not
killer
really.
Computer movie?
No. There might be some overlapping elements, but not really. All right. No, The Seed is a film about three young women. One of whom is an Instagram influencer. Another one is, I think, her publicist. And another one had agreed to come in to like take pictures of her. They go to a really fancy house in the middle of the desert. To watch a meteor shower and take sexy photos for the Instagrams.
Instagram. Yeah.
But in the middle of the meteor shower, something falls in their pool and it smells like shit.
They talk
about it a lot.
About how bad it smells
like an actual. Like, there's actually like, they actually theorize that maybe like a plane up overhead had like dumped its like lavatory load.
Okay, and it landed in the
pool. Yeah,
landed
because it's so grotesque and it smells that bad. We're off to a good start here, by the way.
You know what? I appreciate that though.
Yeah.
Because film is a visual medium, and they have to be able to communicate something that we can't get through the film. I think that's a good way to enrich a film or a book. Yeah.
But it turns out that the thing in the pool is alive.
It's poo monster.
It's a lot. No, it just smells like one. They have trouble describing it. And at one point, there's the two that are supposed to be kind of ditzy and the one that's supposed to be smart. Mm. And the one that's supposed to be smart, the best they can come up with is, it looks like an armadillo made a bear.
Mated with a bear?
No.
Made a bear.
Made a bear.
Out of bear parts.
Out of mud and stuff. Like, I mean, it went to a Build-A-Bear workshop, I guess, and made this thing.
You know
thing.
What? That's certainly evocative.
Okay.
I often picture armadillos sculpting things.
So they've got this weird, grotesque, smelly, injured alien thing in their backyard.
All right.
The middle act is just them debating what to do with it. Trying to get the pool boy to do something about it.
It's a lot. Is it doing anything? It's alive.
It's whining a lot. It's like really. And every once in a while we get a good look at it, and it looks like imagine an off-brand Triumph the Insult comic dog.
Oh, okay.
Covered in KY. Like, that's...
It's just like a goopy
hand puppet. It looks like a goopy hand puppet, and it's really in there. I keep talking about how gross it is, how it's so disgusting. And then later on, they finally bring it into the house, and that's when... it starts getting sexy.
Oh, no.
And I don't know what the fuck to do with anything happening right now. There's, first off, if you're going to make a movie that's just three people hanging out in a house, make them interesting people. Is that a lot to ask? Mm-hmm. I would just like something of note, some hint of character. And if you have their characters, could you maybe have them be consistent? Like the one who says that the show insists is the smart one, the not vapid one. Maybe when people like reference obscure history stories, it should be that character doing it and not the other characters who are supposed to not be smart. Like, that's weird, and I just don't know where we're supposed to be getting out of that. It's just not anything of interest going on. And then, if we're gonna do a story about monster sex, fine. Lots of horror stories are about monster sex. Mm. The Shape of Water is about monster sex.
I've seen plenty of fine films where people have sex with monsters.
Yeah, like, there's something about, there's an allure to a monster.
It's forbidden.
There's a forbidden element to it. They represent the outsider.
Or an untamed libido, that kind of thing.
Something. There's a million different things you can do with a story about monster sex. And ultimately, all this really comes across as is this like really demeaning film about really poorly written women characters who do really shitty, horrible things, right, and then really bad things happen to them physically. And it feels really demeaning and misogynistic.
It's about three young women at a remote mansion having sex with a monster.
Eventually, yes.
Is this a David Dakota movie?
I wish. David Dakota would know what to do with this. Well, David Dakota would understand that this is supposed to be kind of appealing in some way.
Well, or at least titillating.
Yeah. This movie doesn't seem to understand that. Like, it doesn't understand it wants to be titillating, but it also seems to be afraid to be gross. This feels almost like a trauma movie.
The kind of like raunchy sense of humor.
Yeah, like we have a stupid fucking premise. There's a real gross thing that fell into our backyard, and we're debating about what to do with it while we mince around in bathing suits. There would at least be some sort of, you know, prurient, unsavory thrill to that. And this isn't smart enough to say something meaningful about their situation at all. The plot doesn't make enough sense when you actually get right down to brass tacks for it to function as a literal story. And as a metaphor, it's just cruel to all of these characters and really makes it seem like we're here because we hate them or that we don't like them. And at which point I'm like, why would we spend so much time with them? Mm-hmm. It's not like it's a slasher where we're like having like, we're looking at what the filmmaker thinks of are the dregs of humanity and having them get their comeuppance by some kind of spirit of vengeance.
Yeah.
Which, you know, is a little unsavory as well, but at least it's a codified genre and we know why it works. Here, it's cheap. It's extremely poorly acted. The monster is absurd looking and they keep trying to make it look scary. They keep trying to tell you it's scary. And I'm like, no, it looks like Triumph the Insult Comic Dog's puppy. Like, it doesn't work. It's so fucking weird.
If it were actually Triumph the Insult Comic Dog,
then you got a movie.
Yeah.
You have an actual movie here. And I don't know what it is, but it's a weird movie.
Hey girls, this looks like a great movie for me to poop on.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like Triumph the Insult Comic Dog goes to his palatial estate for the weekend, and then aliens fall from the sky with him and all of his girlfriends.
Yeah. And make the puppetry like as awful as possible.
There's a movie, I'm not saying it's necessarily a good movie, but there's a movie there. Like, I don't think you're going to win any awards with that movie, but there's an undeniable, like, appealing pitch there somewhere. This is just mean, cheap, and boring.
Ugh.
And I don't really feel the need to go into much more detail than that because I don't think the movie warrants it. Suffice it to say, too early to call it one of the worst films of the year. It's still March, but it's one of the worst movies of the year.
Oh my God.
It's in there. If it's not in the bottom 10, we're in a lot of trouble. This is going to be a bad year. But this movie, it sucks because I've been of the opinion that Shudder has had, generally speaking, pretty good taste in the movies that they acquire, their original films. They're not all great or classics, but there's usually something clearly to recommend them. So they're playful gore or a really interesting premise or an interesting cultural horror film that maybe would have trouble finding wider distribution, but because they're because it's from a different place in the world and maybe it'd be hard marketing sell in wide distribution. theatrical release.
All right.
But Shudder finds the home for it, and they know how to get it its audience. I don't know what they saw in this one.
I mean, they do occasionally put forth like something really disgusting, sure, some schlock,
just for its own sake.
Yeah, they were the ones who put porno.
Porno.
They put together that really cheap looking and kind of raunchy Critters TV series.
Yeah, but I understand the appeal of this.
Yeah,
I don't understand the appeal of this. I do not understand what I'm supposed to be getting out of this, other than we made a cheap and unpleasant monster movie.
All right.
It doesn't really work, so it's a big old disappointment.
That's too bad. Yeah, Shudder has a great, pretty good track record.
Oh yeah, I'm not mad at them, but like this is clearly like this is a swing and a miss from Shudder. Usually they have a better
curated
they curate their films a little better than this. This is a real bummer of a film. But let's move on. Let's talk about another streaming film.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about The Adam Project.
The Adam Project. This is the latest film from a director named Sean Levy, who has, I think it's safe to call this director a journeyman. He's worked in a lot of just sort of very edge-free, sometimes very effects-heavy, very well-selling, very low-ambition Hollywood pap.
Yeah, he directed
some light romantic comedies. He did Night at the Museum movies.
He did the remake of Cheaper by the Dozen with Steve Martin. He did Big Fat Liar,
which I've heard has like a bit of a cachet with people a certain age, but I haven't seen the
film. He did the first Steve Martin Pink Panther movie,
which is all right.
Which is actually pretty funny. I have nothing against that one.
He did Date Night, which is all right. He did Real Steel, which is probably his best movie.
Well, I think Real Steel is interesting. It's sort of the outlier here because you look at like his other stuff, like The Internship with like Owen Wilson and Vince Vaughn. They're these just generic Pablum movies, and then he did Real Steel right in the middle there, and Real Steel was an interesting film because it's actually like very much in that Amblin Entertainment sort of way. It's a story about a young boy who bonds with his father over the course of a summer while they compete in robot wrestling.
Robot boxing.
Robot boxing. Like, the idea is boxing has been outlawed, so now everyone boxes with automatons that are really cool looking, and they find one in a scrap heap, and they make it an underdog, Rocky-type robot. Mm. And Real Steel slaps. Real Steel is a pretty danged good PG-13 family sci-fi adventure film for everyone in the whole family.
I think it's PG even.
Is it even PG?
Yeah, it's a pretty gentle movie and a good one.
No, it's
for
PG-13.
Kids.
It's PG-13 for robot violence, no doubt.
I think it's fine for kids though. Sure. Like a 10-year-old can.
Oh, I would show this to almost any kid. I would show it to almost any kid. It's no weirder than any action cartoon show they'd find on TV. Mm. Any Avengers movie. There's no more violence than any of that.
It like you said, has that Amblin quality, and I think Spielberg produced that one.
Yeah.
So Amblin Entertainment is Spielberg's production company.
Yeah.
And he did a film called Free Guy just last year, which was a pretty big hit.
I still haven't seen it, Ryan Reynolds.
And that was a little bit high concept for a film of this pedigree.
It's about a non-player character in a video game who gains sentience
and like kind of starts undoing the game from inside. And
fun idea. Yeah, fun idea. I heard it was pretty good. I still haven't gotten around to
it. It's pretty good. There's some really stupid things in it. It doesn't really delve as deep as I think I would have liked in sort of the artificial intelligence aspect. But yeah, there's some fun stuff in it.
Fair enough.
The Adam Project, Sean Levy is going full bore back into Amblin territory.
Yeah.
This is not produced by Spielberg. This is a Netflix film. But yeah, he's reteamed with Ryan Reynolds, who is in Free Guy. And the premise is Ryan Reynolds is a jet pilot with access to a time-traveling jet.
In the future, the year 2050.
It's 2050, and he goes back in time and runs into his 12-year-old self, who's played by a young actor named Walker... Walker Scobell.
Who is quite the find. I think he's very energetic and charismatic.
He doesn't quite have the same sort of Ryan Reynolds smart-ass energy, but he's got a lot of energy.
Yeah.
And Ryan Reynolds is now completely embittered as an adult, and like is essentially trying to tell his 12-year-old self, your life is going to go to hell. You resent that your father died because at that point in the 12-year-old's life, his father died about a year ago.
Yeah.
And adult Ryan Reynolds resents that his father died when he was a child and just came to resent him more as he grew up.
Yeah.
He also is mourning the loss of a wife who is also a time-traveling jet pilot. And she's played by Zoe Saldana.
Yeah.
Thanks to some time travel rigmarole, we'll meet all of these characters.
Yeah. And it turns out that in the future, time travel has been taken over by an evil person now chasing them back in the past to prevent them from preventing this dystopian future from coming into play.
We learn slowly over the course of the film that Ryan Reynolds has traveled back in time to prevent dystopia from occurring.
And because of the machinations of the plot, his plane only works based on his DNA, but he's been injured in the escape. And he's too injured for the plane to think it's safe for him to fly it. So he needs his younger self to operate the controls sometimes.
Yeah, so the scenes where the older and the younger older and younger Adam are interacting are actually pretty good.
Pretty good.
I liked the chemistry that the Ryan Reynolds and the kid sort of developed. Mm-hmm. You could tell that Ryan Reynolds is kind of matching this kid, like quip for quip.
I would not be surprised if, especially early on, before Walker Scobell's young version of the character meets Ryan Reynolds, a lot of his dialogue, when he's like talking to his bullies or his mom, is very Ryan Reynolds-esque, which is interesting because it suggests that his personality was fully formed in middle school, which maybe is a bit of a stretch, but
for movie language, I'm willing to
be surprised if the kid did a lot of acting exercises with Ryan Reynolds, or if Ryan Reynolds even wrote some of his dialogue so that it would really feel like they're playing the same character, because it does.
Yeah.
I'll be fair. It does feel like they're playing the same character.
Young Adam's mom is played by Jennifer Garner, because of course.
Because it's a mom character in a movie with nothing to do, you get Jennifer Garner. And let me explain something to you.
Jennifer Garner has played moms very well.
Yes.
She is now America's mom. For maybe the last 15 to 20 years.
And I'll say this right now. I love Jennifer Garner to pieces. I think she's good at playing the mom. Mm. It kills me she can't get better roles than this.
Yeah.
She's a good actor.
Well, it kills me that nobody can get better roles than this, because this is a severely... It's so difficult to describe this movie because there's so little to describe.
That's the thing that's so weird about
it. We went through all the machinations of the plot because that's the most there is to say about this movie.
Yeah.
All the character moments are very subdued.
Yeah.
All of the action is very generic.
Very much so.
Ryan Reynolds has... it's essentially a lightsaber.
They even say, that's a lightsaber.
And then he has the thing which is really common in action movies, where his superpower is he can knock a radius of people surrounding him back 15 feet. That's something Wonder Woman did. I've seen it in several. That's something that happens all the time in the Avengers movies.
Sure,
just knock people back. That's the superpower now.
Yeah,
that's what
very convenient. Neo did that in the new Matrix movie.
Yeah, there you go.
Instead of doing fight choreography for the most part,
it's really really common to the point of being generic. Here, it's just generic.
Yeah,
he fights bad guys, but they're masked, so you don't feel bad when he turns them into glitter.
He murders them, and he says when you murder them outside their timeline, it does horrible things to them, and they're ripped apart into nothingness. You remember when they did Buffy the Vampire Slayer, the TV series? One of the conceits was when you stab a vampire in the heart with a wooden stake, they explode into dust, like ashes.
Yeah.
And the reason why is because otherwise, at the end of every episode, you'd have to show Buffy the Vampire Slayer and her friends hiding corpses so that they're not arrested for doing all these brutal slayings. It's just an excuse to get rid of the bodies. But here, they mention that on top of it all, it's horrifying. Mm. So it's not even just taking the curse off the fact that we're killing these guys. It actually kind of makes it worse in a way. So he's just slaughtering. This 12-year-old sees his adult self just murder a shitload of people. And he's cool.
I think the only actor who's really bringing it is Mark Ruffalo, who plays the dad. We see him in flashbacks.
He's in all the ads.
Yeah, it's not a big secret.
Yeah.
I feel like he's actually bringing a little bit of intense, sad sack energy. He is acting in rings around everybody else in this movie. He's actually bothering to play a part.
Well, because that's the thing about this movie, and that's the thing that is really keeping this movie from feeling like an Amblin movie. It's on paper, it's an Amblin movie. It's a little high concept, good family oriented ensemble. Centers around a youthful experience. But for the most part, it's not doing the emotional heavy lifting of an Amblin movie. When you're watching an Amblin film along the E.T. Range, those are stories about kids who are already in dramatic situations. It might not be intense situations, but dramatic situations. The kid in E.T., parents got divorced, mom is really holding it together by a thread, and they're feeling the loss, and they're a bunch of latchkey kids who have a lot of time to themselves, and along the way, he finds a new friend who needs him more than he needs even his mom.
Yeah.
And that's one of the things that makes E.T. great. It's not just because an alien landed and we did fun stuff. It's because there was a human story there before the high concept shenanigans began. Here, they kind of got that. Yeah, his dad's dead, and that sucks. But it happened a while ago already.
And he's being picked on at school.
Yeah. But these are all kind of generic things. And by the time Ryan Reynolds kind of whips all that shit out of shape within, like, 20 minutes of being back in time, and then we don't really have this idea of... I think the problem with the movie for me is that it's not centered well enough. It should be all about one of them. Mm. It either should be all about young Adam, and it's focused on his emotional journey dealing with all of these incredible things. Mm. I'm going to find out how I turn out. Oh, I don't turn out that good. Yeah. What does that mean?
And then he has this reckoning about himself.
And then getting to see his dad again, which you would think would be this incredible, like his dad died a year ago. I never thought I'd see him again. Time travel makes it possible. It doesn't seem like that incredible an emotional moment for him.
Not for the 12-year-old.
No, you'd think it would be.
For the adult Ryan Reynolds, it's a little bit more of a
But the pain is so fresh for the kid. You'd think it would be a big fucking deal. And then Ryan Reynolds, obviously he's a bit more jaded, but he has some of these issues like with his wife, but as his young self, you don't have that emotional connection. The reason Mark Ruffalo, I think, is so striking is because all of the real pain and trauma hasn't happened to him yet. Mm. But he takes it all really, really seriously, and he knows he's got his son from the future twice meeting him, and he cares a lot about them. He's a loving dad. So he's got this emotional, grounded perspective that the other characters aren't allowed to have because they're too busy moving about from plot point to plot point. Mm. The movie really needed to pick a perspective here in order for it to land emotionally, because otherwise we're just looking at plot. Yeah. And the plot isn't entirely unclever. There's some fun bits in here once in a while, but it never really explodes enough. It never really comes across as distinctive and interesting enough to justify itself. Like, the action sequences are adequate. Like, you'd see them on, like, you'd see them on Legends of Tomorrow. Like, it's perfectly fine action, but not blockbuster action level wow spectacle.
It's a $175 million movie.
I want to bring that up because here's the deal. The visual effects in this movie are, again, also network TV adequate now. Like, you'd see this on Supergirl and it would look fine.
One of the characters, because it's a time travel movie, will meet a younger version of themselves.
Yeah.
Other than Adam.
Yeah.
And on that actor, they use digital de-aging.
Badly.
It's some of the worst I've seen.
It looks like first generation digital de-aging. Yeah. Like, it's really bad.
And it doesn't help that, and I'm just being coy here just to sort of keep the secrets, but that character, the actor playing that character is so not committed to this part.
Oh, this is a paycheck role. Yeah. This feels like,
Otherwise a very good actor.
Very talented actor. One of my favorites, actually.
Bringing absolutely nothing to the role.
Yeah.
To the point where the two characters are interacting and they're not even bothering to modulate their voice. And it sounds like one person is just reading off the page, both parts really quickly off camera.
Yeah.
No,
it's lousy.
That's another thing sort of weighing.
So the visual spectacle is not there. It's mediocre at best and lousy at worst. And even when you think about, like, okay, they spent $175 million on it. Mm. Okay, so the visual effects, okay, they didn't spend it there. That's fine. Maybe the locations are really cool. Takes place in a house, a garage, and the woods. Oh, and eventually an office.
About a future office. And then there's a climax in a big catwalk factory.
Again, all kinds of shit you could see on TV for $1 million an episode. Mm. Like, it's absurd. I guess the cast got paid, in which case, good for them. But it's not on camera. This is a $175 million movie that looks like a $30 million movie.
Yeah.
Like, it looks inexpensive. Where did that go? I assume salaries, but
actor salaries, and it's not even like an exotic location. Like, they got a vacation out of it.
There's no, like, they used to, when they advertised like blockbuster movies, they would say, "You've never seen a spectacle as spectacular as the long ships," or whatever it was.
Brown boats.
Yeah, well, like, whatever. Like, the point is, like, there was always like a lot of grandeur. Like, you have to see Cleopatra because we spent so much money on it, and it's all on camera. Holy shit. And now it's like, it's been $175 million.
Don't tell anyone
because it looks like crap.
There's this curious thing going on with Ryan Reynolds. Mm. And You can see this in Red Notice. It's also true with Dwayne Johnson.
Yeah.
Where they are movie stars.
They are.
They have that glittering, charming quality. That sort of, not necessarily great actors. I think Ryan Reynolds is a good actor.
He can be, yeah.
I think Dwayne Johnson plays himself, and that's all we need. That's all we require of him.
Sometimes he's better written than others, but yeah.
But all we need is for him to sparkle and be handsome.
They get to coast on personality.
Yeah.
They have a certain type of character they play. They play that character well, and people will pay to see that character.
And while both of them do have hits that we like about them, Ryan Reynolds was Deadpool. That was a big hit. Everybody likes Deadpool.
Everyone likes Deadpool. Deadpool rules. A lot of people love Free Guy. I still haven't seen it, but it was a huge hit.
Free Guy was also a big hit. For Dwayne Johnson, he was in Moana. He played a voice role, but
Moana, Moana. He was in several of the Fast and Furious movies. People really liked him in those.
For the most part, their individual films aren't really wholly beloved as much as they are.
It's interesting, right?
It's interesting that they can coast on good looks and charm and that sort of movie star it quality, and yet still not constantly be churning out hits.
It's so weird because, like, you think about, like, the movie stars of yesteryear, and I realize that not everyone listening is as familiar with the movie stars of yesteryear than other. Like, for example, I imagine most people listening to this show, even if you're, like, only casually familiar with classic cinema, you've probably heard a few names. James Dean, James Stewart, Cary Grant, Katharine Hepburn, Audrey Hepburn, a handful of those.
Humphrey Bogart, all those, yeah.
You've probably at least heard most of those names. And maybe you can pick them out of a lineup. I'm sure you could probably name one or two movies that they were in.
Hey, if they're listening to our podcast, I would like to think.
I would like to think, but
our listeners are well educated.
But hang on, I do want to clarify. We do
when
not
it comes to film,
we do not expect everybody to be on the same exact point in their journey into film. And maybe you're just getting into movies, and maybe you haven't had as many opportunities to delve into the history of film. We all have to start somewhere, and every successive person starts later than the others. So you got some catching up to do. That's fine. I get it. My point is this. For every big movie star that you have heard of from, say, the 40s and the 50s, there are dozens you haven't who had very successful careers, and they just don't last as long because the movies that they made aren't necessarily the ones that people still talk about or remember very much. As a result, you don't hear as much today about Joel McRae.
Yeah.
Or Joseph Cotten. These are great actors. They were in... Joseph Cotten's a better, worse example, actually. He was in a lot of great movies. But, like, he was never the lead in them. Yeah. Like, he was mostly the minor character.
Joseph Cotten, he wasn't on the same level of stardom as...
But he could open other stars of his but he was a noteworthy name, and he could be in a movie and you'd see him and he'd be great. You know, Joseph Cotten's a poor example. Joel McRae is a better example, where he was in a couple of big movies, but they weren't considered Joel McRae movies. They were considered, like, Preston Sturges movies or Hitchcock movies.
Right.
So... Yeah, they had a successful career, and they sold tickets, and then decades later, they're kind of forgotten because they never really had a lot of iconic roles. I think Ryan Reynolds probably has a stronger chance of lasting 50 years now because Deadpool was so huge, etc. Dwayne Johnson probably will have that big, boost from his, like, sports career, but... Yeah, I don't know. I'm actually very curious how in 50 years, unless they each have... some really standout movies that are likely to last the test of time rather than, that was pretty fun to watch on a Sunday afternoon in the summertime. I don't think the Jungle Cruise is going to be brought up much anymore. I think that was just kind of there.
Yeah.
It's strange to me how ubiquitous they are and how successful they are and how much money they're making while not generally producing great film.
Yeah.
It's weird.
And,
they're exceptions, but again, weird,
These aren't movie... I think Deadpool was a particularly good example because I think that's a movie that was a role that played to Ryan Reynolds' strengths.
Yeah, he was made for that role.
He and the role kind of go together pretty well. You can't just sort of throw Ryan Reynolds into any role and have him match the material.
Not necessarily, no.
And I see what they're trying to do with something like Red Notice. It's a caper movie. Let's have a funny guy in a caper movie. Sure. On paper, works fine.
Yeah.
In practice, bland as fuck.
Yeah.
And I feel the same thing about The Adam Project. This is sort of like this Amblin-esque meeting your younger self time travel adventure. Let's put a charming, funny Ryan Reynolds in there. Should work? No, actually, I think
he's so flip. You don't actually get that real emotional connection.
You would do better with a little bit more of like a sadder actor. Somebody who's
Patrick Wilson.
Patrick Wilson would have been good.
I think Patrick Wilson would have seen this like smart alecky kid who turned into Patrick Wilson.
Or Jesse Plemons would be another good one. Just somebody who can play up like the sadness of the character.
He's a little bit
more of a defeated character.
He's a little too much of a movie star for the type of role this needs to be. This actually needed to be more interesting than that.
Yeah.
And not just cool.
And Ryan Reynolds can bring cool.
He can.
And he's doing what he's asked. But
he's doing exactly what he's asked to do. But
it doesn't work here.
And you see him trying. There's like this scene early on where you realize that like he realizes that in the aftermath of his father's death, he didn't treat his mother very well. Mm. He's got a good line, which is your mother is taking care of you. No one's taking care of your mother. Mm. And he's right. The kid is young and he doesn't appreciate that mom is actually going through some serious shit right now. And he's kind of walking all over her and being like, you know, kind of a problem kid at school. And it's making life really, really hard for her. And he says, like, you know, as I grew up, I realized I was an asshole to my mom and I love my mom. Mm. And there's a scene at a bar where he gets to just run into his mom by chance and say nice things to her so that she feels appreciated. And you can tell that this is supposed to be this really sweet kind of moment and it doesn't quite hit.
Yeah.
It never quite connects the way it should.
You know what? There was a scene just like that. You're talking and I was reminded of a scene in the movie Freaky.
Oh, yeah.
Which was a horror movie where, a teenage girl and a vicious serial killer swap bodies Freaky Friday style.
Yeah.
Fun, high concept.
Very fun, high concept.
You know, 8 out of 10. It doesn't nail everything, but it's fun.
It's one of the people who did Happy Death Day, so, like, it's got a lot of cleverness, but also works as a horror movie. It's great.
It works as a horror movie. There's some fun queer stuff in there as well.
Yes, very much so.
But there's a scene in that movie where the teenage girl's mom sees her in the body of Vince Vaughn and, like, tries to have a conversation and sort of the things they say to each other about the teenage daughter, like really touches her in that moment. Yeah. Or they're like in a dressing room.
Well, just basically like, I think talking about how you could connect with your teenage daughter better. I know I've had like a teenage, up a story about how we could know about
that moment in Freaky.
Yeah.
Is way more emotionally resonant than anything in the Adam Project.
Well, because that is, there's a specificity to what they're going through there. Whereas in the Adam Project, it's just like, my son doesn't appreciate me. And Ryan Reynolds like, he will. He likes you a lot. And she's like, cool, thanks. Mm. Wait a minute. Was that my son from the future? And how would I know that? And there's like that moment where she's like, wait a minute. Who was that not masked man? I would like to think that maybe she was like really freaked out because she thought it was Ryan Reynolds.
Yeah.
It's like, Ryan Reynolds? He just gave me advice on how to raise my son? How nice of him. I don't want to badmouth this movie too much because I actually think it's a perfectly pleasant watch, but it's also completely forgettable. And that's the problem. It's like it never goes that extra mile. It never adds that emotional contingent that could make it really stand out and be memorable. The action is never so exciting that that's enough and you get enough spectacle from it. It just feels kind of there.
Yeah, to use a word I'm trying to steer myself away from to describe films, but it's content. It's something to fill the algorithm.
Yeah.
And that's not something you want from a $175 million genre entertainment picture.
No, this is, for me,
actually has some modest Amblin
vibes. For me, this is mediocrity. Some people are bringing it more than others, but it all ends up being like, I don't hate that I watched it, but I'm never going to need to see that again.
Yeah.
And that's a bit of a bummer. Mm. But let's talk about the last film that we're reviewing this week, and normally it's one we would have started with, but it's also about parent-children relationships. It is a new film from Pixar called Turning Red.
It's called Seeing Red.
No. It's Turning Red.
Oh, it's Turning Red.
And how did you do that? Okay, fine. It's Turning Red. Jesus. Turning Red.
It's called Turning Red.
Turning Red is a story of a young girl in Canada in the early 2000s. Her name is Mei Lin, and her family runs a temple dedicated to their ancestors, one of whom had a magical connection, so they said, to red pandas. And have you ever seen a red panda? They are fucking adorable.
They're fuzzy little, like, cat-sized critters.
Yeah. And Mei Lin, our protagonist, is a very good kid. Mm-hmm. She loves her parents. She helps out around their work. She's got good grades in school. She's very attentive. She has friends.
And she's very proud of all this.
Yeah. And she should be, honestly. Mm-hmm. She's got her shit together better than I did.
Mei Lin is so energetic and confident.
Yeah.
Which is wonderful.
Yeah.
I love, you love the character immediately.
You do.
She's
wonderful.
So great. And
she's a delight.
And the relationship she has with her three best friends, all of which are very fully realized. They all
distinctive
have like really
characters. Yeah. You know who, you know who's talking based on what they say and how they say it. And...
One of her friends, Abby, is like freaks out with every single line of dialogue. I love Abby.
Abby's great.
But I like all of those friends.
They're all one.
They have a very close relationship. Yeah. And this is something I deeply, deeply appreciate. They're never, ever once treated as archetypes.
No.
That's a big trap that a lot of kid movies, school set movies fall into. That
yeah,
they
the
fit
cool
into,
kid.
They fit into like
the popular girl. There's no
cliques here. They're just kids with distinctive personalities
and
going to school.
And have a small
group
of friends each. Yeah.
Is, you know, it's not so cliquey as the movies would have you believe.
Anyway, the plot kicks in when Mei Lin discovers for the first time that she might have a crush on a boy she knows, as opposed to, like, a member of a boy band, this abstract concept of a boy.
And this is another thing I appreciate. She has a crush on several boys.
Yeah.
She's a little boy crazy.
Sure.
This is a movie about adolescent lust.
Sure. Yeah, it's about discovering...
And all the awkwardness there.
It's about discovering your interest in people, whether it's the opposite sex or the same sex, or it doesn't matter. Mm. But it's about discovering, oh, now I'm romantically interested in people, and her mother finds out about this and completely freaks out. Because there's a whole embarrassing incident, and when she wakes up, basically puberty has been jump-started. Mm. But instead of just having to go through the usual indignities of puberty, she is also transformed into a gigantic red panda.
Yeah, like an 8-foot tall red panda.
Yeah, like difficulty fitting in a room.
Like a
red
big,
panda,
big,
like a monster,
big gigantic monster,
adorable, but a monster.
And the movie doesn't sugarcoat its puberty metaphor.
No, it's pretty fucking obvious. Yeah, in fact, they talk about a lot of it directly.
There's boxes of pads in this movie.
Yeah.
The mother uses the phrase has the red lotus bloomed or something along those lines.
Yeah,
little cute little
maybe
metaphor.
Peony, I think it might have been. But anyway, yeah, and so mom just thinks. Puberty hit today, and this is a big day for my girl, or at least that's what we think. And then it turns out this whole turning into a red panda curse
is an inherited trait.
Every single woman in their family goes through this, and every single woman in the family has an opportunity to basically it's going to affect you for the first month, and then the next time the full moon rises. Again, a lot of metaphors here. The next time the full moon rises, you'll have an opportunity to expunge this from yourself forever and ignore this sort of wild side of you. And over the course of a month, Mei Lin realizes that, A, she has some control over it, and B, she might like this side of herself and might not want to change and might want to actually break this cycle of all of the people in their family sort of committing themselves to a very particular traditional value. And that's going to create some problems and schisms within the family. As metaphors go, it doesn't get a lot cleaner. We've seen this is part of a grand tradition of sort of transformational teen media in America. In particular, we had films like Teen Wolf or Teen Witch or Buffy the Vampire Slayer. Overseas, we had stuff like Ranma One-Half or Sailor Moon to varying degrees, where adolescence comes with the ability to transform into heroes or monsters.
Well,
or,
I mean, that's kind of...
Or different genders, even.
That's kind of what the X-Men have always been about. One of the conceits of the X-Men comics is you gain this sort of like random superpower at puberty.
Exactly.
Like that, when you hit puberty, that's when your superpowers manifest.
Which makes sense because like puberty, when and if you go through it, it feels like your whole body is changing. Everything is changing. I don't know what the hell's going on. My voice is different now. I'm getting all of these random emotions. Like I might as well get laser vision. Why the fuck not?
I may as well. Yeah. And in this movie, I may as well turn into this gigantic furry monster.
Yeah.
And you know, I don't know how to deal with my body, and my body is completely different from something I recognize, and I'm having all these new feelings.
Yeah.
The ambition of the movie then becomes, how can she traverse her new body, as well as feed her lust for a boy band?
What she tries to do is raise money to go see this boy band with her friends.
That's
like this rite of passage. They say, like, we will enter the concert, girls, and we will exit the concert, women. Mm. You know?
Four Town.
Four Town is the
fictional band.
And I will say this, Four Town puts on a good show.
I think Billie Eilish wrote sort of the Four Town songs and
wrote or co-wrote. Yeah, co-wrote, yeah, they're involved. And yeah,
they're pretty spot on. I admit I was listening to some of like the boy band music in the early 2000s, so I could like sing you songs by Element, spelled L-M-N-T. And other teen bands besides.
And it's a clever bit of writing too, that music, because it's very difficult to, when you're talented at something, write something a little subpar without it becoming parodic, like you're calling attention to it. Like, haha, no, I really know what I'm doing. Like those
do you
four
remember,
times.
Do you remember Du Jour from the Josie and the Pussycats movie?
I actually never saw the Josie and Pussycats movie.
I think you'd enjoy it.
Everyone tells me I'd enjoy it. I'm waiting for a good opportunity. I will definitely see it. I know it's wonderful. Everyone's told me it's wonderful. I'm sure they're right. I haven't had the opportunity yet. I'm waiting for the right moment. But to write those, and again, there's a few exceptions. There's some really good NSYNC songs out there. I'm not going to pretend otherwise. But a lot of that boy band trend were songs that sound pretty good, but the lyrics are atrocious, or the sentiment is weird, or they're all kind of forgettable, but they're still catchy enough that you can listen to the whole thing on the radio without even thinking about it. And they nail that. In fact, the thing I think I love most about this movie is how specific it is and how much detail they put in here. Like, there's this whole ongoing subplot, which pays off with a Tamagotchi. Remember those? If you don't remember those, if you're too young to remember those, Tamagotchis were this interesting fad at the turn of the century. They were like little...
I feel like 2002... Well, I wasn't in Toronto in 2002, but in America, I feel like it was a few years before that.
They were starting to peak, but... Tamagotchis were like little key rings with like a little digital character on it. Like you'd see like effects that you'd see on like a digital watch, not like a good
iPhone. Little LCD display. Yeah. There were three buttons on it. And there was ostensibly inside of this little egg, a living digital pet.
Yeah. And you had to actually maintain its needs and feed it. And
comes from the Japanese word for friend, which is tomodachi.
Yeah. And the idea is that you actually...
Tomodachi, you had to feed it, take care of it, make sure it slept.
Because
like,
it could die.
Those things did die.
They could literally die. And I think that's an interesting... They find a good way to use that throughout the story. I love the hell out of this movie.
It is so sweet.
It's funny. It's got really wonderful characters in it. I'm not going to say it's beyond criticism. There was... let me make sure I remember who wrote this, actually.
Written and directed by the same filmmaker.
Oh, yeah. That's not who I was thinking of. Walter Chaw wrote a review of this movie, which...
Oh, I love Walter Chaw.
Walter Chaw's a brilliant... One of the great film critics we have, as far as I'm concerned. I don't always agree with him, but he's brilliant.
And a beautiful snot. When he hates something popular, he really digs in.
He writes it in such a way that it's like you see exactly where he's coming from. Yeah. And here, his criticism about this movie is actually an interesting perspective, and I do want to call attention to it. Please read this review. It's excellent. Where he's talking about how, unfortunately, this movie, the word he uses is a unicorn, where there aren't a lot of movies, especially from Disney and especially from Pixar, that are taking the perspective of Chinese people or Japanese people or anyone really. And the idea is that by falling back on some familiar tropes that we're familiar with these types of characters and these types of stories, no matter how good the film is, it can never possibly feel progressive enough. And it actually ends up kind of feeding into some pre-existing storytelling dynamics, many of which are a bit reductive, even if this movie does them well.
I've seen this going way back. Sandra Oh, who plays the mom in this movie, was in a movie called Double Happiness, which is actually, you know, covers a lot of the same ground as Turning Red. This was also, you know, another film about sort of the Asian American experience, Crazy Rich Asians, the John M. Chu movie. Also covers a lot of this sort of intergenerational pressure, which, you know, is what I'm learning from the movies is very common in Chinese culture.
Right. But one can also call that reductive.
It's reductive, and it's, if you use it too many times in a screenplay, it becomes a screenplay trope.
It becomes a stereotype.
No matter how true it is to life, it becomes a screenplay trope.
Yeah, and that's why it's a little unfair that this movie has that much responsibility and it doesn't have the freedom to even make any mistakes, because it does feel like it has a lot of responsibility to make up for lost time.
Yeah.
And that's unfortunate. For me, all I can say is that's a very valid concern, but I still like the movie we got. And I still think it's a lovely film made with a lot of wit and charm. The third act, I'm not going to tell you a damn word about it. So much clever shit happens in the third act. Uh-oh. Just really good storytelling. Like, actually really smart, you know, playing with a lot of different familiar genres and incorporating them into this teen coming of age story in an unusual but very effective way. Just a delight.
Yeah.
An absolute delight. This is one of my favorite Pixar movies. This is at least in my top 10. Maybe it could rise.
It's way more frenetic in a way, yeah. Just from scene to scene, than most Pixar movies are. Pixar movies are usually incredibly mannered, which is in a way that I appreciate, actually. Yeah. Where they're going for a certain amount of emotional earnestness. And this really captures a lot of the turbulence of the adolescent emotional state.
Yeah.
The main character is animated in this very creative way where she's got all these kind of like weird jerky movements. She's constantly zipping around in the screen because she's just so full of energy, and her friends as well. They all are kind of copacetic in that way. It's only get really scaled back when she's at home with her parents. Her parents are actually much more slow moving.
Yeah. More reserved. She's matching their energy.
Exactly. Yeah. And I appreciate that she is going through all of these sort of like personal upheavals and bodily upheavals. And that's reflected in every scene in, like, just her movements and her the visual, like, animated acting.
It made me feel about how much we're kind of missing some of that stuff in Luca, which is a much more... there's some elements of it there in the early sort of... early scenes between Luca and the other merperson, whose name I forget, where they've got this sort of wonderful energy to each other, but... Yeah, that doesn't really feel like they're pubescent in that way. In that way where everyone's just like, you know, full of hormones and making mistakes.
They're a little younger in Luca.
Like, I guess they're a little younger. Not much, though.
Luca, I think, is 11. And
that feels like splitting hairs to me. You don't think
there's a big difference between 11 and 13. Okay. I just want to say. All right, there's a lot going on in those few years. And,
fair enough.
Yeah. I appreciate that it didn't shy away from its puberty metaphor. Like, it just put it right up front. To the point where it's just bleeding obvious.
Yeah. I do feel like there are some things they shied away from. There are definitely elements to at least one, probably two, and maybe more side characters where there's definitely some queer coding going on.
Yeah.
And as we've recently heard from actual animators at Pixar, every time they try to put any queerness in their movies, the Disney Corporation tells them to cut it out.
There was... there was a brief moment, it was like a split second, where it was implied one of the characters might be queer.
Yes.
Where two girls begin dancing together, and they pan over very quickly to their friends, and they kind of make eyes at it, like, for a second. And I think that these two girls might have had a thing.
I feel like there's at least one other scene with one other character that might suggest that, and if they had more freedom, they might have gone there.
Yeah, maybe so.
Yeah.
It's not a big part of the story. It's actually not hugely important. It would have been nice to have a queer character.
I feel like it's relevant because we're having that conversation about Disney right now. We're talking about how they've given money to politicians to help fund really horrifying anti-LGBTQIA+
legislation.
And you know, now that they've been called out on it, they're like, okay, well, we'll give $5 million to a charity, which turned it down, by the way, because it's obviously an empty promise.
It was the $5 million Human Rights Campaign.
Yeah, $5 million is nothing
compared to what Disney does. Yeah,
and literally nothing compared to the harm that they've done, and nothing in their pocketbook. It's less than the least they could do.
I've been writing this up. I write for Slash Film, and so this is coming through the sort of the news cycles. I've been writing up stories on this and how the CEO has been like just putting his foot in his mouth and then opening his mouth, taking one foot out and putting the other one in. It's just
bad.
Completely awful.
Yeah, and Disney has a long history of this kind of shit, about being really regressive on purpose for a long, long time, and only being forced into it when they think they can make money.
It's been really frustrating to see the company getting credit for progressive characters when what they're doing is like the least progressive thing they could possibly
They're trying so hard not to give you any progressive characters that even the tiniest crumb of a progressive character is something that they are allowed to celebrate in their publicity.
Yeah.
And even though it's usually something so small that it could be cut out of the film so that it could be released in a more homophobic culture without any fanfare.
Here's a montage where two women kiss. You can cut that out in a homophobic market.
Yeah.
And still get credit and money, and it's guess what, Skeezix, we know that's not going to work anymore.
And you know, I'm bringing this up because I think there's an element of this that kind of feels like it relates to Turning Red, but also because I know a lot of people who are having a serious conversation right now about how much they want to even work with Disney in terms of like reviewing their films. The question is, would it be better if we stopped giving them the time of day until they got their shit together? And well, I think that depends on your point of view. I think there are a lot of film critics who can make that decision for themselves. So I think where I'm standing right now is I think that we bring up their bullshit every single time we can so that no one forgets it. But I don't like the idea of letting Disney, which has an enormous market and an enormous influence on mainstream audiences, mm-hmm. and children in particular, I don't like the idea of giving them a free pass to release whatever they want without any critical analysis.
No, in
so
fact,
I want to make sure we do talk about that, but I also want to make sure we always put the context in when it's relevant.
I agree. I think I'm going to go one further and say that somebody that is a company that is reaching such a large audience and owns such a large share of the entertainment marketplace needs even more scrutiny.
I agree.
They need more than just some smaller studio that's only going to reach a limited audience, and we'll actually probably have a lot more, I'll just say it, courage to tell a story with a more diverse cast and types of characters.
And
that Disney is trying to get brownie points because they put out like publicity about how they have all these queer characters for doing less than the bare minimum.
Agreed.
Okay, there might have been a queer character somewhere in Onward. Why isn't the main character a queer?
Why isn't any of the main characters queer? Why can't or why isn't the character who is queer allowed to say so beyond one quick line of dialogue?
Yeah.
You know, like it's bullshit.
So that's not progressive.
No.
I've heard it called passive progressive, and I like that term.
I like that term too.
So when we're having these conversations about Seeing Red, I said it again, Turning Red. I think it's totally legit to bring up these criticisms of the company.
And
a lot of the animators of Turning Red have were a little bit miffed that it's going straight to their streaming service and not exclusively in theaters.
Mm-hmm.
Or at least both. I'm glad it's reaching a broad audience because I actually think it's quite a good movie.
Well,
I think this is an earnestly told story from an artist who wants to tell a good story.
Disney monopolizes so much of the marketplace. In America, particularly for stuff like animation, but just in general, they own so many of the most successful intellectual properties. They produce so much of the movies that are being made that they hire talented people, and sometimes they can make really good movies. And that's something that Disney, even at the original Walt Disney's worst, and he did some really shitty things. He also did some really great things, and mostly it was because he hired talented people and let them work.
Yeah.
Talented people made Turning Red. Mm. And in this particular case, I think the movie is so excellent that I don't want this to get completely lost in the shuffle of a really important conversation we're having about the corporate practices.
Yeah.
But the movie is really good.
Well,
and I do want people to see this film because I think this movie is excellent. I understand if you don't want to give Disney money right now, maybe wait a little bit if that's the case. But like, this is an excellent film, and I hope it finds an audience because this is a really funny, endearing, illuminating, nice. And I don't nice is feels like a lousy adjective because it's so generic. But it's just what a wonderful, sweet film this is. I adore it.
It's funny, it's sweet, it's energetic. Yeah. It's one of the instances where the executives and even the makers of the movie need to watch their own stuff.
Yeah.
I feel the same way about the movie Ender's Game.
Yeah, we talked about this before. Yeah.
And this is actually a sentiment I'm repeating that was put out by Dave White. So I'm not taking credit. But Dave White, we watch the movie Ender's Game, and that is a pacifist movie. That is about welcoming the alien and realizing that a war is the ultimate grievance, not just something one civilization can do against another, damage to your own soul.
It's cyclical, and it hurts everyone.
And ultimately that bleeds directly into children who are just being fed all this propaganda. It's actually a very sophisticated idea for this movie.
Yeah.
The author who wrote that book, Orson Scott Card, is a horrendous homophobic bigot. Who has given a lot of money to horrible things. Yeah. So you buy his book, some of that money is going to go to these homophobic groups. He should read Orson Scott Card.
Yeah, because that story
learn the lessons that are in those books.
It, what he has actually been supporting is antithetical to the message in his best book, which is fucked.
Yeah, so
if you think about it, that sucks.
Orson Scott Card is a horrendous bigot, and I don't want to give him dime one. But I think that the lessons in Ender's Game are incredibly good.
Yeah, it's ironic.
So yeah, if you don't want to give money to Disney, don't.
Yeah.
I'm not going to make you. And if you're going to boycott this gigantic entertainment company that has a monopoly on everything, fine.
Yeah, there's a perfectly valid reason to do that. Yeah.
That decision. They're too big.
Yeah.
Okay. It's a pity that something like Turning Red is going to be sort of a casualty to that, because I think there's a lot of good art that the company puts out.
Right.
And I think they hire a lot of talented artists. But I think they make good entertainments.
But if the message of a boycott is to, you know, you're also making some sacrifices. Mm-hmm. Oftentimes, with a boycott, you know, you're cutting out something you enjoy or a convenience, and because the principle is more important than that. Now, again, as critics, we're still going to be covering a lot of Disney stuff when it comes up because we feel like we don't want to give them a free pass or anything. Turning Red happened to be a very good movie, but Disney also puts out a lot of crap.
Yeah.
So we need to basically give them more scrutiny because that's our job. But it's not everyone's job, and not everyone wants to cover their job the exact same way we do, and we support them for that.
Yeah.
So, anyway, just to have that conversation, because it's been coming up a lot lately. Let's review some movies on the critically acclaimed scale.
Mm-hmm.
Once again, the critically acclaimed scale goes from C- to C+. At the end of the day, we give a film one of three ratings. C+ is above average.
It's okay.
Yeah, well, not just okay. It could be just okay, but it's good to great. Anywhere in between. It's a legitimate recommendation without much reservation. C is average. C is, you know, some people are going to be more into it than others, but it's a mixed bag. There's good, there's bad, or maybe it's only just okay or not quite terrible enough to warrant a negative rating, but there's something that isn't quite clicking.
Yeah.
C- is below average. That's a movie we genuinely don't recommend, either because it just isn't very good or maybe it's because it's unbelievably terrible. So, on that note, Whitney Seibold, where do you rate Turning Red?
I give it a C+. I like Turning Red a lot. I love the characters.
Yeah.
I love the main character. I love my only real complaint, Walter Charles' complaint, is sort of lurking there in the background that these are it does bank on stereotypes a bit.
Yeah.
And like a lot of movies that are about sort of earnest emotional states, I think it gets a little too lost in action and mythology by the end, where there's like a lot of chases and stuff. But I was so wrapped up at that point that I was willing to forgive a lot.
I think they handle it.
It's still quite a good movie.
I think they handle those elements in a clever enough way, and they're still always rooted in the character dynamics that... And they could have gone in so much lazier directions in terms of action than they do. That I think it actually works. I really, really like this movie a lot. I think this is a really wonderful coming-of-age film. It's very funny. It's very, very sweet. It's ultra-specific, and I think that makes it all the more universal.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I like it a lot, and I do hope it finds an audience. Next up, The Adam Project.
Oh, that's a C-. There's nothing to recommend this movie. It's slick. It's efficient. It's got big movie stars in it. And it will leave your head, and that's not something you really need to spend your time with. So, C-.
I'm going
to
give, for me, this is the definition of mediocrity. Which makes it a C. It's just it's a generic sci-fi stuff. It's not a hard watch. There's some good bits in it. You're right. Mark Ruffalo kind of steals the movie because he's not trying to. He's just trying to play the character in a real way. You won't remember it. But unlike Red Notice, which was just like nails on a chalkboard to me, it was so unbelievably
obnoxious,
so unbelievably insincere and phony. This is like, listen, we tried to make a 4-star movie. We had the actual tools to make a 3-star movie, and then we made a 2.5-star movie. And that's not great, but it's also not hard to watch. So I'll give it an unenthusiastic C. Let's see. Then there was, The Seed.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to talk about The Seed anymore. It's a C-. It's a real... And you know me. I can be really forgiving with horror movies. I understand... I understand modest ambition. And I can respect modest ambition. This is not that. This feels like an incredibly unformed bit of cinema. It's nowhere near intelligent enough to be stupid. And it's not stupid enough to be fun. It's somewhere in the middle there. It does not work at all. And I don't think you should see it. But hey, what do I know? And then lastly, Diana the Musical. Let's go back in time ourselves.
This is one of those, it's a C-minus movie, but it's okay. Also one I kind of recommend just because it has this almost like a train wreck quality. Like okay. Every decision is bad. The songs are really bad. It's just so misguided. It's one of those things that you're going to want to share with friends.
So it's a C-minus, but a secret C+.
Kind of a, yeah,
If that sounds like something you really want to see, to you, it's a C+.
Yeah.
But to everyone else, it's a C-. Okay. I like it. Mm-hmm. All right. We'll be back next week with more reviews. Ha ha ha.
That's what we do.
You thought you were rid of us. And there, you were wrong, because we'll be back. Mm-hmm. What's coming out next week, Winnie?
What is coming out next week?
I was hoping you knew. hold on.
Yeah, I had it all written down.
We've got the new horror thriller, Amma. We've got, what do we got here? I think Cheaper by the Dozen comes out, that new Disney remake.
Okay. That's a
remake of a remake.
Zac Efron, I think.
And other things as well. There's a new horror movie on Amazon called Master. There's a new Ty West thriller called X.
X is coming out.
I don't know if I'll be able to get to that, but I'm excited about it. I like Ty West as a director a lot. Yeah. So there's stuff coming out, but mostly all the big stuff got out of the way of the Batman. So, yeah, that's it for Critically Acclaimed. Thank you, everybody, for listening. If you would like to join in the conversation, anything we talked about today or anything else you would like us to discuss, you can always email us. Our email address is letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. We also have a P.O. box for people who prefer snail mail. Whitney, what is our P.O. box?
Yeah, send us an actual physical letter. Send it to the Critically Acclaimed Network, P.O. Box 641565, Los Angeles, California, 90064.
Yeah, we're also on Twitter, @CriticAcclaim. I'm @LaneBibiani.
I'm @WhitneySeibold.
And of course, we have a Patreon, patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork, where we have a lot of exclusive shows. For people to enjoy, shows about Batman, the Academy Awards, Star Trek, commentary tracks. We just released a commentary track for Some Like It Hot, the classic queer rom-com with Tony Curtis, Jack Lemmon, and Marilyn Monroe. We also have a commentary track coming up very soon for St. Patrick's Day for Leprechaun.
That classic.
Because we couldn't resist. We'll be doing
that. Sometimes we do good movies. Sometimes we don't.
Sometimes we do Leprechaun. And we have other stuff going on as well. We have Google Hangouts every single month. Thank you to everybody who's a patron. We couldn't do this without you. And if you want to join in, there's a lot of stuff. There's a giant backlog already waiting for you. Keep you busy for hundreds of hours. Anything else? That's it. Okay, great. Thank you, everybody, once again. And never forget, everyone's a critic.
I want to go to the midnight show. I'm sorry, what?
And everyone is Fabio.